I want to thank everybody for coming here today. This is a terrific turnout. We're very excited to have you here tonight for a terrific event. This is actually our third or fourth, I can't remember, event that we've had. It's sponsored by Kivett, and we're really grateful to Kivett for their sponsorship this evening to help make this event possible. As well as a number of other sponsors, the Chicago Association of Realtors, WGN Radio, who is recording this here tonight, Reyes Kersen, outreach experts who put together the event this evening, Daly and Georges, and Neil and Leroy. We're very grateful to you all. So just to tell you a little bit about us, if some of you are not regular readers, we've been going for about 2 years now. We first launched AlderTrax Racing Form, is what it used to be called. Can you turn it down a little bit? I know people like the old name. We launched in October 2014, and about 1,500 people have purchased a racing form back in the day. And hundreds now subscribe to our weekday first report, which comes out every morning at 7:30, which I'm guessing you're getting every day, because if you bought a ticket, you're getting a free subscription for a month. And we've also got a great podcast called The AlderCast. If you're not listening to it, this conversation will then show up on The AlderCast tomorrow evening. It's on every Friday evening, and you can get it on iTunes, WGN Plus, Google Play, and all the other fine locations where you listen to podcasts. And thousands more receive our free review email, which is all the great stuff, but without the really terrific original reporting that our reporters, Claudia Morell, I just saw you walking around, and oh, there you are, and A.D. Quigg, who are sitting in the front. Good for you. And then also I want to thank my two partners who help with us as well, Jim Dispenza, who's here, and then also Ramsen Cannon, who is actually earning money for his real job. So if you are a subscriber, you know about our annual report. If you just started with us, you probably haven't seen it yet. Free PDF download for all subscribers. It was last October. We do it every year. Every Chicago commissioner and board member, all those tiny little boards that you think you know everything about, we actually keep track of all those people with their contact information, updated aldermanic bios and staff contacts. Now we do county commissioners as well. It's about 200 plus pages. Download it, print it out, go nuts. It's a lot of fun. And then also, I'm not sure how many people of you saw on Wednesday, we had a terrific report led by Claudia Morell, a development map that had every major development in the city for the last 19 months mapped out. And then when you click on one of these little points, you get all the details, the square footage, the architect, the attorney, a little bit of background, maybe a picture. So this is an incredible resource. And really shows a lot of things just plainly right there for you to be able to see. So without further ado, I want to introduce our guest this evening, Mr. David Reifman, Esquire. David Reifman is a native Chicagoan who was appointed commissioner of the Department of Planning and Development in August 2015 by Mayor Emanuel. In that job, he is responsible for leading the department's housing, economic development, planning, and zoning bureaus while fostering community improvement projects and initiatives. As commissioner of DPD, he serves on Chicago Plan Commission, Community Development Commission, and Commission on Chicago Landmarks, among others. He is chairman of the board of the Chicago Development Fund. Previously at DLA Piper, David represented the Chicago Cubs in the deal to rebuild and expand Wrigley Field, worked on redevelopment of 200-acre Ryerson Steel site in Pullman, and also worked on the CTA Wilson Yard redevelopment, which is now a very nice target. He's originally from Rogers Park. He went to Sullivan High School, go Tigers. He got a bachelor's and master's from U of I and received his law degree from Northwestern University. Everybody, please welcome David Reifman, Commissioner David Reifman. All right, so one last thing. We have this super exciting, cool thing that we've done a number of times that works really well. If you go on your phone, if you go to thumbs.thedailyline.net, we also have Wi-Fi logged in there. If you go to that address, you can type in a question that I will then see on this very iPad. And you can vote up and vote down your questions. So if you ask a dumb question, everyone else will know. If you ask a smart question, everyone else will know too. And so then as we go through our conversation, then I'll be able to ask the questions that you pose. So let's get started. So why did
well,
you...
Well, Mike, before you start, I just want to, first of all, I want to thank you for having me here. And I do open the daily line every morning, and I think I speak for everyone in saying that I'm very glad we're finally at this event, so that when you open up your daily line tomorrow, you no longer have to see my picture at this event.
It's a really good picture.
We're finally here.
It's a very good picture.
And thank you very much. And I'm glad we're at the event. And
it's one of the better commissioner pictures.
Thank you very much.
You should be proud. Okay, so let's start off. So why did you leave the private sector in order to come here and work in the city?
Well, I had an extremely satisfying private sector career. I enjoyed what I did day to day. I see some of my former colleagues who are here today joining us. I think, you know, throughout my career and throughout my life, I have always felt drawn to some form of public service, whether I did pro bono work in my private practice, regardless of what it was, there's always been a desire to do something more than be in a role of a lawyer. And so when the mayor reached out to me, asked me if I'd be willing to take this job, it seemed like the ideal opportunity to me to give back to the city I grew up in, to the city I feel I've made a large contribution to in private practice, and really try to have an impact on the direction the city would go. So that's really the bottom line, is that I'd never served in government. It had always been a kind of an attraction to me, and this was the right job at the right time to really take my skills, my experience, and try to do something for the city as a whole.
So when you started as commissioner, you made a lot of changes that streamlined operations at the Department of Planning. Plan Commission moves a lot faster, and you consider a lot more things in about half the time that you used to. DPD has Twitter now. That's amazing. You do a lot of other outreach work. What sort of things are you hoping to be able to do in the rest of your term?
Well, I think, you know, I came here, I gave the mayor a commitment that I would work in the administration through the second term. And that's basically how I'm looking at it. I thought, you know, you mentioned things like Twitter, Facebook. I thought we needed to do a better job communicating ourselves what we think we're doing. You know, I read the press, I read what you do, I read all of the local newspapers. Everyone has their own take on what's going on, but I felt, first of all, we needed our own platform to communicate what we're doing, what our initiatives were, what our programs were. I think in the time that I've been here, I've looked at things that we could do, not just to streamline the process, but I think, you know, from my experience, I've been through many cycles of real estate and real estate markets, and certainly we're in a long period of expansion. It's important as a city that we capture as much growth as possible and take advantage. So as we moved projects through, I wanted to get these things moving more quickly, make the process more bearable for the public, more bearable for the plan commissioners. So that was one of the things we tried to do, was streamlining and moving things along. Let's understand what the projects are. Let's come up with our comments. Let's be reasonable about what we need. And I'm not afraid to make certain decisions in the capacity of commissioner, given my experience, what I think will happen. I can assess the risk of what I think will be successful and what won't be. We're obviously in the middle of a significant effort with planned manufacturing districts, but I think overall the approach that I've tried to take with it is, how do we have a more equitable approach to planning and development in the city? So we began, I think, you know, the ARO began before the Affordable Requirements Ordinance began, before I got there, and I was sort of part of the transition. We developed the concepts of equity through the Neighborhood Opportunity Bonus. We want to do similar things with planned manufacturing districts in our industrial corridors. I'd like to see all of those initiatives through. I'd like to continue to support our strong transit orientation in this administration, you know, in the various ways that it manifests, whether it's transit-oriented development or transit improvements, and other large initiatives. We have significant development opportunities that, that everyone is aware of, whether it's planned manufacturing districts or, you know, the shorthand term of Finkel, or whether we're talking about the 62 acres on the river, on the south branch of the river, or the lakeside property, the down Lakeshore Drive, the former U.S. Steel site, or Michael Reese, the post office. These are opportunities for the city to capture growth, capture opportunity, create jobs. I'd like to see all these things moving forward. I guess the last thing I'd mention as a significant initiative right now is all the potential activity related to the Obama Presidential Library. Again, an amazing opportunity for our city to see growth, opportunity, and neighborhood economic opportunity as well.
Okay, you just talked about everything I want to ask you about.
Well, we can get into details.
So, let me ask you about the Clybourne Corridor, since you mentioned PMDs. Mm-hmm. You know, as a commercial destination, it's been booming for years, and yet most of the industrial businesses are gone that were there meant to for PMDs to be protecting, or they're moving out. And it seems almost like a foregone conclusion of some of that is going to become residential, but what density is reasonable, and how do you go through that thought process? And how much commercial is realistic, considering how crowded the corridor is already?
So, well, let's start with this. First of all, I think it's a little bit of a misnomer to call it the Clybourne Corridor. What we have in this area is really the currently known as the North Branch Industrial Corridor. It extends all the way down to roughly Carroll Street with Blommer and goes all the way north to, actually to Fullerton and Elson. The actual corridor is, 750 acres, which has an enormous expanse. The PMDs are a part of that. And we're looking at all that. So part of what we'd call the Clybourne Corridor, or the commercial part, that's largely developed. And I think what we're seeing is that not all businesses have left. A good number of businesses have left. But we're seeing some significant large tracts, such as the Finkel parcel, which is 23 or 24 acres, Sims, the troop site that we have, that we as a city are marketing as well. And we have to manage transition and understand that the manufacturing landscape is changing and has changed. What do we want to do as a city and an area to continue to support growth in this area? I don't think it's only a question of residential, but I think what we're certainly seeing and what we've studied and what we know the market demands when we look at cities like Seattle, when we look at Boston, when we look at Portland, when we look at places that have had significant industrial transitions, not dissimilar to what we're seeing, that the manufacturing landscaping is changing, the jobs opportunities are more business-to-business and tech-oriented, and there's a demand for a certain type of environment where those jobs can continue to grow. And in that context, I think residential is something we need to consider, and not everywhere. And if you look at the plan, we put it out last week, one of the things we've done in our process is I think we've done a good job listening to the very disparate demands of different stakeholders in the area. And we've identified a continuing area for planned manufacturing districts that deal with certain critical services that we have. We have, we still have concrete, and we still have paving contractors, and we have transfer stations. And that we don't want to put residential right up against those. We want to protect those essential services in our city. But in other areas, I think we need to be open to more. The more of the changes that the market demands, that the workforce demands, we put in the plan that approximately 50% non-commercial is the right number, but I think that's something we'll test and we'll let play out over time. So that's the philosophy of what we're trying to do. And, again, we're just trying to reset the baseline. The development community, the owners, they'll actually try to come in with the plans. They will be the ones to initiate those specific
So proposals. You mentioned other cities. Can you talk about other cities and neighborhoods that you've looked at that are reasonable comparables that you would like to mirror or what you'd
Sure.
Like to do?
I mean, I think there's a couple what I think are pretty, if you look at, let's take South Lake Union in Seattle. That was an industrial area that went to Seattle Mixed Use. That was their zoning district. We looked at that. We studied that. The Boston Port, we looked at what they did there. We looked at SoMa in San Francisco. And honestly, we have our own tradition, our own tech world, our own experience in places like Fulton and other places. So we drew on all of those experiences And we listened to the owners, we listened to the community, we listened to developers, and tried to put together a plan that kind of balances all those things. But those would be, I think, the primary examples of places that have managed that kind of transition away from traditional manufacturing.
So let's talk broadly about PMDs then. First created in 88, actually the Clybourne area, the North Branch area, had one of the first ones for Finkelsteel. But they don't necessarily seem to be fostering new industrial construction in that area. And others, it could be argued, would probably be industrial land anyway, because they're in reserved parts of the city that are kind of far away from pressures of other kinds of development. Is it time to end our 30-year experiment with PMDs, or are we just not doing the right sort of things in order to encourage development, industrial development in these areas?
There are 26 industrial corridors in Chicago, and as you point out, they're dispersed throughout the city. And I think if you look at the details of our plan and you look at what we're looking at in terms of employment trends, you do see things like areas like the North Branch corridor, which is converting heavily to high tech, to business to business. You see that in the Kinzig corridor, which is the area west of the loop. But as you move even further west in the Kinzig corridor, you see a continuing need for ongoing manufacturing. You see it in, throughout the city. And I think if you look at what we're trying to do, back to the original point I made about, equity and how we're leveraging, how we're trying to leverage the strengths of our economy and provide opportunities in our weaker markets. One of the things that we've talked about on a preliminary basis so far in areas like the North Branch is creating a financial structure where we look at as an entire ecosystem. We're not simply looking at the North Branch, but that we can derive resources from the strength there to support activities in other areas of the city. So if we look at areas that we think can still experience growth, and I think those exist, we need to continue to create resources. We're not solely focused on the North Branch. We've also created an entire industrial growth zone program. Part of that is to try to facilitate industrial growth where it wants to go. Take the very example of Finkelsteel. Their move was from the North Branch to Burnside, where they had more rail access, better electricity, supporting their activity and their move to that location. That market still exists, and the 300 jobs they took there still exists. We want to facilitate industrial planned manufacturing districts where they make sense and allow the transitions to occur in an orderly, appropriate way where we no longer have that same need we had in 1988. So that's a long way of saying I don't think that the time has come to abandon that. The time has come to rethink the ecosystem as a whole, but to support that ecosystem as a whole. We want to continue to attract the Whole Foods distribution centers, the Method plants that will still come here. We have we're optimistic about industrial growth on the west side at Roosevelt and Costner. Those types of things, we want to create resources to level the playing field, bring those companies here, and capture as much manufacturing employment as we can.
So, and those are great victories, the Method plant and the new spot in Lawndale that you just mentioned that work is just now beginning on. But generally, Chicago is losing industrial jobs, and it's being thought of much less of an industrial city than it was 30 years ago. Are they external to Chicago? Is it something that we just can't help? Is there something that we could be doing that's not development, or is there more development tweaks that we should expect coming from your office in order to try and encourage more industrial development in Chicago?
Well, I think it is to a great degree external, and external both at a global scale, at a national scale, and at a local scale. So, to some degree, we're reactive. We're presented with what we have. We have to address those situations as they arise. I think, especially in the mayor's second term, we're very focused on making this as simple as possible. So, again, you take the industrial growth zone as one of our initiatives. Part of what we're trying to do is, aid the speed to market to make us more competitive with states like Indiana, to attract people here, to allow, to make our taxes more competitive with other counties, to deal with environmental issues up front, to create and to capture what we think we can capture in terms of what our local market will support. We still have important food clusters. We have last mile distribution. We have various opportunities in traditional manufacturing that we should continue to capture. And at the same time, again, where we kind of started is we need to look at the world as it is changing. We need to look at advanced manufacturing. We need to look at business-to-business tech and what all that represents. You know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, I would say that the percentage of tech and industrial that represented, you know, a fraction of our local economy. Today, I think we can say that's 12-13% and growing. We want to continue to grow where we can, continue to create opportunities where we can, and just be prepared for the 21st century. You know, when I was a kid, there were probably 600,000 in traditional manufacturing jobs in Chicago. I don't think we see that. U.S. Steel is gone. Finkel Steel has moved to a smaller, you know, more compact facility. Those types of industries are not here with the types of jobs that they used to have. So it's really our job as a city to manage that the best we can in some very challenging, you know, circumstances today.
So let's shift a minute to talk about TUDs. So in that map that we generated and looking at all the data, we don't have it up on the wall, sorry. We looked at the last 19 months of development permits, and we saw that of the 100 or so proposed during that time period, of the TUDs that were proposed in that time period, few were actually really significantly higher density projects, maybe a quarter of it, maybe a third. But the vast majority were two flats and three flats, taking advantage of TODs in order to be able to make some changes to their facility, their location there. Are TODs working in the way that you want it to? Or should we expect to see more tweaks so that there are more TODs that are built out?
Well, I didn't know that. That fact about the two flats, because, you know, typically what I'll see at my level are the larger projects. But let's go back to the origin, you know, the origin of TOD. So I think what we've done, and I think if you look at the, when TOD was technically put in as an amendment to the zoning ordinance, in the ordinance, the incentives were basically around two different things. One, parking, and connected to that, some affordability. But it basically allowed for a little bit of additional room within what we'd call the -3 districts, right, the B-3 districts. What we actually see happening, though, is that most developers are choosing to go straight to a -5 and do a planned development. So in terms of that original intent, it hasn't really been executed the way it may have been planned in terms of what you would hope to get out of that. But what I do think you see and what we recognize is that within a certain geography of transit, and we've expanded that geography, we want to encourage and take advantage of the infrastructure we have, which allows us to do what I think is probably the single most important benefit people take advantage of, which is reducing parking. So people can do less parking. We acknowledge the data about parking supply. We locate it close to transit where we're investing heavily and try to make that synergy where our public investment in transit is coupled with a private investment in additional development. Now, by also doing that upzoning to -5, it also triggers the affordable requirements ordinance, so we're able to get additional affordable housing. I am also continuing to look at this and trying to understand, especially where we are in the current market, if there is more we can do. If there is something we want to do more in the neighborhoods to encourage it, I'm really kind of at the inception of my thinking. As with the original TOD, we'll try to come up with some additional things. We'll run it by the marketplace. We'll run it by the mayor. We'll run it by the aldermen and, you know, whose wards are affected, the communities who are affected, and see if there is more we can do to advance the policies of transit and affordability. I think those are the keys to any additional changes I would want to look at. If they don't have those benefits, I'm not sure that we need to spend a lot of time on it.
Well, and that actually leads into another issue, which is that density seems to be changing a little bit in terms of the city, in terms of what neighborhoods have density and what don't have density. And traditionally, density used to be very centered into the downtown area, and now it's being spread out a little bit. For instance, areas like Jefferson Park. And there's a lot of talk about increasing density in Jefferson Park. Should we be expecting to see a lot more of these sort of projects where there are outgrowth areas where we're trying to encourage more density, or is that just an outlier?
I don't know if it's an outlier. I think, you know, again, first of all, I think we're seeing density still in the downtown. I think one of the things we did when we did the neighborhood opportunity.
I'm sorry, I don't mean that downtown doesn't have density.
But my point is that what we saw was pressure to expand the original areas of downtown because we see that density pushing. We see it pushing north. We see it pushing northwest, southwest, that the physical boundaries of the traditional downtown, as it was defined under the 2004 zoning ordinance, that we're seeing pressure to move that density out. But then, you know, to your point, we're seeing what you're really pointing to is the activity we're seeing on the blue line as we head towards O'Hare. So you've seen that kind of desire for density extending down Milwaukee through, you know, the traditional Logan Square area and then all the way to Jefferson Park. And I think part of that is that that corridor is tied to jobs and opportunities both in the city and in the northwest suburbs. So I would like to see us take advantage and capture more of that. You know, the Jefferson Park community is engaged in a little bit of, let's call it community dialogue about this issue. And it's not a settled issue there yet. But, you know, from a policy perspective, I think we want to capture the density where it goes. I'd like to see it push southwest. I'd like to see it go south. We have a lot of opportunity on the Green Line as we move south. I'd like to see it extend, you know, again, TOD can mean a lot of different things, and density can mean a lot of different things, but we do want to capture density, capture growth where we can. And again, part of it is we want to take advantage of our strengths, our infrastructural strengths, our transit system. We don't want to continue to spread. We want to try to focus it and make progress around our assets.
Any particular areas where we should expect to see more development and growth of that sort?
I'd love to see us continue the trends that I think we're seeing as we move south into Bronzeville. I'd like to see that extend all the way to Woodlawn. I'd like to see, you know, we're continuing to study, you know, and move the red line further south. We want to give people access to jobs, access to neighborhoods. I think those are extremely important priorities for us in this administration. But I think we've seen some of that progress. We have as a city, we have a taste for that success, take advantage of opportunities like the Obama Library as development moves south and continue pushing it south and southwest and gain that opportunity around transit.
So, and that's actually a really interesting point that you bring up, development moving south. The Obama Library is an excellent example of great development, but a lot of the development that's south of Cermak, shall we say, is really along the lake. And there is large portions of Chicago that just are not seeing the same kind of development that you're seeing in other parts of the city. What can be done about that? What sort of tools do you think you could be using, or what tools do you think you need in order to try and increase development in those areas?
Well, I do think it's challenging, but I want to say that I think there are a lot of tools that we're trying to bring to bear. So the Neighborhood Opportunity Fund is one way we've identified various areas coupled with what we have launched as retail thrive zones. So by investing in key strategic corridors, which have that ability for catalytic change, that have strong community partners, because we have lots of strong community organizations throughout our city that are dedicated to their communities. Working with groups like LISC, which have undertaken a significant focus on 63rd Street and the entire Southwest Corridor, that we can make progress in those neighborhoods as well, taking advantage of things like the Neighborhood Opportunity Fund, hopefully a new industrial fee that we'll try to launch to create opportunities in other areas of our city. So, you know, again, part of what I have tried to bring to this position, what I hope to bring to this position is as creatively as possible to balance resources and leverage resources to try to do that for as many neighborhoods as we possibly can. Even as we move west, what we can do with transit, Lake and Dame and other places, to try to address that very question. So yes, we're opportunistic where it happens. We're opportunistic on the north side, on downtown, northwest side. We're opportunistic to some degree with the Presidential Library, meaning we're taking advantage of the opportunity and the investment that's there and using where we can, creating resources for those communities that are well organized, can try to get things going, bring retail, bring housing, invest in those areas as much as we possibly can.
You know, while you're talking about those kind of tools, do you have any idea of
what kind of an impact it would make on your future planning, if some of President Trump's proposed cuts to community development block grants would have? Do you know what the dollar amount of that is for Chicago?
Well, we don't, because, you know, as the mayor would say, a budget is a policy statement, and we know what you know the Trump administration's policy statements are as reflected in that budget. I don't think we have any specifics yet as to how that's going to affect CDBG funds. There's nothing through Congress yet on it. I think it'd be hard for me to speculate. Clearly, we want those resources. We need those resources. You know, you saw today on the Trump Care Act that Senator Durbin today came out with his estimate of the potential negative impacts of those types of programs on Chicago. That's something that we don't want to see reversed. So it would be too speculative to really to know what the impacts are on CDBG. That being said, whether, you know, what, like with transit, other things, we're going to do the best we can with the tools that we have. We're not going to stand still. We're going to continue to, you know, work as hard as we can to put the resources we can into our communities. But certainly that's not something any of us would want to see happen as a cut to CDBG funds, transit funds, you know, those types of, you know, Medicaid, other things that are extremely important to a city like Chicago.
Okay, so here's a question that a number of people from the audience had, and I'm going to roll back to PMDs. Currently, communities on the fence line of planned manufacturing districts are not considered as part of the community planning decision-making process. How do you see a resolution, if any of all, of this lack of community engagement? So, you know, essentially, I think the question is that there is a line that's drawn about who you invite into the discussion for PMD planning in the future, particularly in the North Branch. You know, how do you, but there are still people who are affected in this area. How do you work to bring those people
I'm
in?
I'm not sure I totally get the question, but I'll give an answer I want to give.
All right.
So we'll see if it works.
I thought it was a smart question.
I would
question.
Say, I'm not sure exactly. I mean, I can speculate as to where the question comes from, but I'm not 100% sure. So if you look at what we did on the North Branch, we took the area of the North Branch corridor, and we actually drew a line a half a mile around it so that we could get the input. We've had, I can't even tell you the number of meetings, but I think 9 major meetings, probably 60-something meetings. I have the data here. I could look at it. But, you know, I would say this is one of the most extensive and expansive input processes that we have seen. We have received, and it's not, you know, uniformly going in one direction. There are things that are, there are people who want, excuse me, considerably less residential than we're talking about. There are people who want more residential than we're talking about. There are people who think that the open space will conflict with our goal as making it a job center in an industrial area. People who want tremendous amounts of open space going in here. So what we've tried to do is balance. I think we've done a very good job of collecting, listening, hearing, incorporating over a year period of time, evolving our thought process, listening to individual stakeholders, listening to community stakeholders, the entire range of people who care about what goes on here, and trying to come up with a plan that really addresses to a great degree everybody's interest. We have a plan that focuses on industry. We have a plan that focuses on, you know, on employment environments, by which I mean mixed-use environments. We have a plan that talks about up to 50 acres of open space in various ways that's compatible with that environmental area. We have a plan that talks about transit improvements and the way to make this more bike-friendly, environmentally friendly, more accessible to transit, different links, short-term, medium, long-term approaches to this, ideas on how to go about funding it. So I think we've done a pretty good job listening to it. There are areas around there where we'll continue to look at the potential impacts. I don't know if people are drawing conclusions by the fact that we are ultimately focusing right now on the industrial corridor. And I want to say, we're still gathering input. We put out our draft for a 30-day comment period. It hasn't gone to the Plan Commission. Each time we take something public, we listen to the public, we listen to the stakeholders, and then we incorporate changes in our next draft that hopefully reflect some kind of synthesis or more deeper thought about how those issues should be addressed.
Okay. So let's talk about affordable housing.
Sure.
Many people have called your goals for affordable housing ambitious. Can you talk a little bit about what your thinking is about what's a reasonable, equitable, affordable housing goal in Chicago, and how you have your thinking about this? How do you formulate what is a reasonable goal and what Chicago should be accomplishing?
Well, to some degree, I kind of came to that issue because when I started, September 2015, effectively, the new ARO had already been passed. And I think you have to take that ordinance extremely seriously from a bunch of different ways that it really does represent our policy as a city. There were dozens of different stakeholders from all across the spectrum of the issue of housing who were part of task force and advisory groups on how to improve the old ARO to make affordable housing more effective, how to address the issues of on-site affordable. And I think that that will remain the primary document for affordable housing in our city. And that document tries to balance, like many things, the weak market, strong market, and the transition and increased value that's derived from the strong residential marketplace. We have to have a city that is inclusive. We cannot have the type of workforce we're talking about unless people can afford to be here. We have to have places where where development can occur and we can balance out the requirements of affordability. Our requirements, in my opinion, are reasonably modest. If you look at what it is, 10% with 25% of that on site or in certain areas within 2 miles of that area. On a 100-unit project, you're talking about 3 affordable units. And it's affordable to people on a rental basis at 60% of area median income. These are our teachers, our policemen, our firemen, our people who need to be here, work here, live here. So I would say that our affordable housing ordinance does a good job on balance. It also balances other important policy objectives. So while on-site affordable is important to as an overall objective, our ordinance also creates resources to do other things. It gives us the ability to create resources for multifamily housing that we can invest in as a city, which is affordable multifamily housing throughout the city. It gives us resources for people who live at 0 to 30% of area median income, for our homeless population, for our SROs. So through our strong market, again, we support all kinds of different programs. So the types of things I would like to see us have a strong affordable housing policy. There's continuing pressure to do more for affordable housing. And I think we have to continue looking at this. We want to balance out the needs of the market, financing, all those things, and take advantage of that. But affordable housing has to be a central tenet of our overall planning and development objectives as a department. And, I think that is strongly the mayor's feeling about those issues.
Do you prefer to see more on-site units, or is the in-lieu fee just fine? Is that process, that balance, okay right now?
Well, again, I say I came to this debate late in this particular role. I think that was a long conversation that I really didn't participate in this particular position. I think the idea that we're trying to do two different things here. We're trying to do many different things here. One, we're trying to allow the market to continue to develop and create the number of units that the marketplace wants. Number two, we want to create affordability without displacing people, which requires affordability to be in the area, on site, or within proximity to those projects so that those areas continue to be mixed income and affordable for people there. And we need to continue to create resources for affordable multifamily, affordable housing programs, and SRO and homeless support. So that's a lot for our ordinance to do, and I think we're trying to balance all of those different objectives. I think we want to continue to try to do that and improve it and create more resources. So I would say overall, from a policy perspective, the ordinance is very good, certainly not perfect. Everyone has comments and either complaints, whether you're on the side of the more affordable housing or the less affordable housing, I think it probably means we're doing it about right.
So to put it another way, for people who say, well, we should be putting more effort into having on-site units, there's a flip side of that, which is, well, if you have more on-site units, there's less cash in order to be able to spend on these other programs.
Yes, and different communities have different perspectives on that, right? So some communities, certain aldermen, when you have projects, they want it completely on-site, and they're addressing a need and a perception in their community that it's just leaving their community at a certain pace they want to keep it there, and that does solve that problem there. Other places, you know, Alderman would say, we have enough affordable housing right here. We need less here. We need to create more resources, not in a particular project. And a particular project may not be the best place for that. We need that offsite too. So, you know, it's not ad hoc, but it's trying to navigate what can be a very complex set of demands for the right balance.
So are there other ways to be achieving the goal of affordable housing other than ARO? I mean, like, are there changes to building code that we could be doing, or zoning, like more allowing more English basement apartments, you know, more coach houses?
I think the answer to that is yes. I think that we do. I think that we want to continue. We are looking at that, and I'm continuing to look at that. I mean, if there's one thing I spent a lot of my career doing, it's zoning, and I want to keep looking at how we maximize what we're able to do through zoning tools. Zoning, in my opinion, is a low-cost tool to try to accomplish some of those objectives. So in terms of building code, Commissioner Friedland recently announced, and the City Council, I think, has passed various changes, you know, for rehab, for electrical code, other things like that, to try to make that housing more affordable. I think we do want to look as a preservation, you know, preservation is less expensive than new construction. So again, how can we get more units into the system? What can we do? What makes sense? How do we navigate the community issues? I know that Alderman Moore is here. I saw him. There he is. Alderman Moore, as you know, is the chairman of the Housing Committee. We have spent some time talking about what some of those tools could be. How do we create more affordability through the zoning process, but make sure that we're getting what we think we need, long-term affordability for people who really need it. You know, so again, this is an ongoing conversation. Alderman Moore and I are both committed to that proposition, but that's something I think we want to continue. I would be remiss and look back on my time here with regret if we did not advance the ball on affordable housing in the city.
It almost sounds like there's maybe a package of changes that you're thinking about.
I'm trying to test and understand where we are in the market. I'm trying to see if we can do more things along the lines of leveraging that we've talked about here that are that can create more resources. And before I really take it further, I want to kind of develop something. The mayor has directed me to continue to look at those resources. I want to sit down when we have better ideas about how this could work, get more input, and then, you know, see where we go with all of that. But again, it's a high priority of the mayor. It's a high priority of all of the aldermen in the city, and we want to see this. I want to come up with as many tools as we can to advance the ball on that. So whether it's a package, a single package, interdepartmental, between buildings, between planning, all those things, that's what we should be doing. That should be our priority amongst all of our other priorities. But housing
okay.
is one of them.
So should we expect to see something moving in the, within this year or something?
Well, I think you can tell I can have a moment, you know, a little impatient streak in me, and I don't like sitting around and waiting. I want to get things moving. I feel my window is in this job is limited, and I want to move it as quickly as possible. So the answer is yes, but I can't tell you exactly when.
Well, let me know.
I will. You'll be the first.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's great. So going a little more broadly, Chicago continues to lose population. Mostly on the south and west sides. Are there things that you are doing or that you could be doing or want to be doing in order to help arrest that decline?
I think that is the loss of population is an extremely complex result of all kinds of different issues that it would take forever to get into here. I think what we try to do are some of the programs I've talked about where we want to work with communities in various ways by being targeted, by being thoughtful, and trying to reinvest in a lot of these areas that have lost population while continuing to grow those areas that the market naturally is gravitating towards. So again, I think I'll just give an example or two, and, you know, again, just to call it a few places. I think the the activity that we've seen in Pullman is a great example of how we work to continue to build community around the resources we have. The types of things that we're trying to do in Englewood around the corner of 63rd and Halsted with our investments in retail, our investments in housing, our investments in infrastructure, our investments in public, in libraries, in parks, and things that make places communities of choice. Again, as we work through our challenges as a city, with our issues with public safety and our issues with schools, that we continue to make our neighborhoods better places to live. But attracting business, that is what we work 24/7 on, to grow the city every which way we can, and to create, it improves our tax base. It takes the burden away from our existing owners by growing the city, and we need to really stem that tide of population loss. Again, you raise the question: are these things that are external? I think to some degree they are. We're a Midwestern city. We're an industrial city, and we're trying to transition on the fly in terms of a global economy that's changing.
So talking about trying to attract development, talk about the Method Factory and the Whole Foods Distribution Center. What did it take for us to be able to get those, and how do you repeat that process and do it again?
Well, I will give a quick shout out to David Doig and Chicago Neighborhood Initiatives, they're here today, and you can certainly talk to them afterwards as well and their experience. I think it takes dogged determination at various different levels. You take the opportunity that's here, and again, it's somewhat opportunistic. We have a mayor who is extremely dedicated to trying to get those opportunities every time they can, who personally rolls up his sleeves and calls CEOs, calls real estate directors, whatever it takes. So to get someone like Method, we competed. We made it competitive with Michigan and other places, and they came here. They sought the opportunity to get the type of workforce that they wanted on the South Side and participate in that. Whole Foods, very similar. Whole Foods has shown quite a commitment to the city, not only at 63rd and Halsted, but with moving their distribution center to Chicago. Some of it is just constant working, hustling, talking to companies. We continue to have, I think, significant success at this level because we have knowledge, we have universities, we have resources, assets that we promote to companies and our workforce, and our commitment to a skilled workforce that brings people into Chicago. So whether it's corporate headquarters downtown or places like the Method and the Whole Foods Distribution Center, it really is people working extremely hard and using the resources we have, whether it's tax increment financing, whether it's a new industrial fee we may use, whether it's neighborhood opportunity funds, tax classifications. We want jobs, we want development, we want things that ultimately will help grow the city. So it is just constant work on a day-to-day basis to show people the true benefits of being here in Chicago and what we offer as a city.
How does a project like that get onto your radar? I mean, obviously, people that are thinking about Chicago, they give you a ring. They say, hey, I'm thinking about Chicago. What can you do for me? But do all these things, do they always contact you up front, or, you know?
There's no one way. I mean, there's 100 different ways, whether we're out there recruiting, whether we're going to, to recruit retailers at the shopping center conventions, whether we make a list working in coordination with World Business Chicago, here's the companies we want, whether it's opportunistic, and some companies do come to us. It's all of the above. So, there's no one single way that we do it, and certainly we prepare, we work hard, and we certainly look for the best opportunity, again, for the mayor to get most involved. He got me to do this job. He's a very persuasive person when he wants to be. So, he talks to people, and he is, people don't sometimes realize what an amazing place Chicago is to live, to work, to locate your company. And part of it is just making sure people understand that. Sometimes we just have to level the playing field be competitive with other places.
Sometimes hard to get them to move in, but way harder to get them to move out is the story I've heard about Chicago. You're trying to recruit people from New York or L.A. that once they get here, this place is the best. I know you're going to agree with
me. I'm a big fan. I mean, I'm...
I'm a booster, too.
Well, so, you know, you're trying to, well, actually, I'm going to jump to this one question because a lot of people are asking about it. What can you tell us about the Michael Reese development?
Almost nothing.
Really?
Really. I mean, this is an RFP process. Here's what I can say. We put out an RFP. We tried to cast a wide net. Part of what we did is we put criteria in the RFP that we think fairly reflect the types of things that we would expect any potential successful bidder to achieve. We took into account a long community process that occurred, a guided community process, and the needs of those communities. We look at what we need in terms of financial feasibility. We understand that there are environmental issues with it. We take a very realistic approach. We cast a wide net. The reason I really don't want to talk about it is, number one, we're in the process of evaluating it. We have technical committees that evaluate the financial feasibility, the marketability, the land plan, compliance with the community standards, all of those types of things. And we are also the land seller and owner, and I don't want to put us in a competitive disadvantage on what we may be able to achieve for the city. So, I have a long experience negotiating real estate projects and deals, and you just don't want to show too much of your hand at an early stage. So we're coming on it soon. We have, like with everything, I think we try to be aggressive, efficient, get to the point. We want these projects going. We want that, we're working closely with MPEA so that we can take advantage of both of our resources here. And I think that would be about all I would want to say about it at this point. So stay tuned, but I think that's, other than to point out, it's one of those major sites that the mayor is very focused on. He was focused on when he asked me to take this job, like the old post office, Michael Reese, the 62 acres, Finkel, the U.S. Steel site. These are the big, big undeveloped properties that we need as a city to move along. They will help our city in so many ways. That's one of them, and that's really about what I can say right now.
All right, then how about the old post office?
How about it? post offices, they continue to make progress. I think we developed what I think was a very effective strategy to move the ball on that particular project. We have a developer who is well-capitalized, committed, has experience with a similar type of project of a similar scale in New York. This property was in building court. We have an agreed order and an agreement on timing and schedule, and progress that we expect as a city. We have weekly check-ins. We are in constant, monitoring of it. And, I think right now everyone, all the departments that are involved are thinking that we are getting what we expected. We are seeing progress. We're going to see all kinds of, more visible changes in the coming months, but they're working hard. I think it'll end up being a great success story for the city.
So another question from the audience, which actually I think is kind of interesting, is what do you think about urban farming? Do you give any consideration to that? I mean, there are large sections of the city which are raised buildings and they're open spaces. And I hate to make this comparison, but they do it in Detroit. Is there any thought about doing more urban farming or encouraging urban farming so that some of this space is actually used?
Well, I think that is consistent with what we try to do. And so we have a program that that many of you may have heard of called Large Lots, which is a way that we are trying to put vacant lots back into the hands of people in the community. And those lots can be used, you can get them for a dollar, they can be used for open space to beautify your lot, they can be used for urban agriculture. We've done some urban, farming incubation in the city. I think it is certainly an experiment we want to continue to look at and do. I think that we don't yet know if it's truly sustainable and scalable, but it's an important program that we should continue to try to encourage. We have a plan called Green Healthy Neighborhoods on the South Side, which prioritizes urban farming, and I think that we have to see how it goes. But I think getting land back into the hands of the community, makes it safer, improves value, and makes a more productive use of that land. So I don't have more to say about it other than I would love to see how it goes. I don't know how successful it has or has not been in Detroit, but we have our own approach to it, and we'll see how it goes. There's back to method for a second. That's not what you mean by urban farming, but on the top of the method is the Gotham Greens facility, which supplies super fresh greens to your local Whole Foods stores that, you know, literally is grown in Chicago. They have, I think, of a Pullman brand, a Pullman leaf. You can get, you know, all kinds of different types. That's one type of urban farming where they've made a certain kind of investment. I'd like to see more local. I think, again, and I'm not a booster for Whole Foods per se, other than to say that we've been very happy with our partnership with Whole Foods. At 63rd and Halstead, you have local people who have started things in their kitchens and in their yards, who are developing products and vegetables and are able to sell that in the Whole Foods. So we want to continue to encourage that, support that, see where that goes as one of many opportunities to address our changes in the city.
All right. Well, we're coming up on our time, so I'm going to ask one last question, which I think is kind of a cute question from the audience, which is, after DPD, what is your dream job?
You know, I have no idea.
Catcher really, for the Cubs.
Yeah, I'm not good enough. I was never that good. and I'm way too old now. I would say I was a catcher at Sullivan High School.
Were you?
I was.
Awesome. How are your knees?
Probably better now. But I don't know the answer to that question. I honestly, I left behind what I had as my law career. I'm really very, very focused on this job. I'm here for, you know, another, you know, couple years. I want to really see what we can do in terms of changing the city. You know, I meet all kinds of different people. I don't know. I do think it's a I think it's moving forward, right? It is, you know, I can have an impact on the city in this job and try to have a positive impact and see where that takes me in terms of continuing to have that impact. But I think that is probably the most important thing, is to continue to find a way to impact our city, our country, equity, equitable development, what we can really do, make a difference and do something better for the world. It really is about public service. I see it trying to evolve from that. So I don't know more than that today. Right now I have my ideal job. I'm doing it. I'm focused on it. I'm hyper-focused on it. And we'll see what's next in a couple of years.
All right, perfect. Well, thank you very much, Commissioner Reifman. Everybody, can we have a big round of applause? I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
It was terrific. And everybody, please join us. We'll still have more cocktails, so please stick around.